You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We'd like to thank our two sponsors for this Spycast, Harry's and Blue Apron. Thank you for continuing to be integral members of the Spycast family. You'll hear more about them later, but first, let's meet our guests. So we're joined today by Ilya Zavzlovsky, who is a former employee of the oil company TNK-BP, which is a subsidiary of the Anglo-American company British Petroleum, where in 2008, he was accused falsely of being a spy by the Russian FSB and security services controlled by Russian oligarchs. He is now a visiting senior fellow at the Legatum Institute and also writes for think tanks in Washington, D.C. Apart from academic work, he continues as an energy consultant for U.S. and European companies, focusing on analysis of regulatory risks in developing countries and the spread of corrosive practices to the West. Thank you, Ilya, for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Thanks for having me.
So you are Russian in background, but you have U.S. citizenship. Your parents came over here to the United States. They wanted a better future for you and your family. What made you eventually want to go back to Russia? Because Russia's going back there is what got you in a bit of trouble. But what were you originally doing? What were you doing when you were working for this oil company?
Essentially, we got U.S. citizenship because we had relatives here. And to be frank, as a young person, I thought that Russia was changing for better. And I treated U.S. citizenship as sort of my insurance. Yeah. And something that I might use more in future, but I wanted to go back to Russia and do positive changes. I graduated from Oxford University in 2004, and most Russians wanted to stay in the West, but there were still quite a few, not just me, who wanted to go back. And I was very interested in energy efficiency and Kyoto Protocol. I was fascinated by some presentations in Oxford from oil companies. And I thought, there was future for Russia together with Western companies to do something good for Russia in the long term.
I mean, this is a time when people are already kind of starting to whisper about Putin and his cronies, but no one probably in the West certainly realized what level it was going to get to eventually.
Yes, there was already a Yukos affair by the time I went back, but people were still talking about legal and administrative reforms. And there were plenty of Western companies expanding their presence in Russia. So I was disillusioned and understood all about the regime only by around 2006, 2007.
Well, this is a time you had a U.S. citizenship. You work for a British oil company. You're friends with people in the British Council and other Westerners. This seems like it's ready-made for them, very convenient to call you a spy when they wanted to raid BP. So you can talk a little, people are like, what do you mean they wanted to raid BP? Can you talk a little bit about what the Russian government was trying to do and was using you to try to do during this time?
Yes, I was one of the pretexts to do corporate raiding in Russian style. In the West, the corporate raiding is usually understood by some aggressive acquisition or merger. Russian style, it's bringing 100 policemen in uniforms and black masks, laying everyone on the floor, searching offices for 2 days nonstop. It's propaganda on TV and radio accusing British managers of being and British Council being a spy platform, or me being head of Ukrainian spy ring, with no diving into details, but just broad accusations. At the time, Russian state companies, helped by Russian security services, FSB, and Russian shareholders of TNK-BP with their own security. They wanted to take over BP's assets in Russia. And for that, they made an assault on about seven fronts on the company. So I was one of the central fronts, a fabricated spy case, but not the only one. So back tax claims, environmental claims, all of a sudden they have like seven labor inspections, wrong visas for British managers, and so forth. The list is endless.
Well, I mean, this is really redefining the concept of hostile takeover. I mean, this is as heavy-handed as it gets. A lot of people may not have heard of this case. Did it receive any media coverage? Was this something, your case in particular, but also the takeover of BP, was it something that was known around the world, or was it kept tightly inside Russia?
Interestingly, it received two waves of short-term attention from global media. So on the day of our arrest, it was me and my brother who were detained. All global media, from New York Times, CNN, to European media and Russian media, they covered this, but they didn't have a clue. They just said two brothers accused of espionage and had to make some conclusions based on rumors, and because there was the only information that was released was by FSB,
right,
which said some absurd things, like they said they found CIA business cards on us.
because any self-respecting spy would be carrying around the CIA business cards. Like.
Obviously, and they exist. You know, all CIA agents are issued with CIA business cards and gold.
Yes.
And they pass it to their agents. The second wave was during our verdict in May 2009. I had to dig and understand, piece together all the things from the case after I left Russia in 2010. And it was only by 2012 when I put the whole picture together, including by using WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks covered the case quite extensively through reports of BP managers to American embassy in Moscow. And those reports reveal a lot. They show that BP understood at the time very well who they're dealing with. About 150 managers from BP were harassed by KGB methods. They were followed on the streets. Their apartments were invaded. They've been invited to all sorts of aggressive interrogations. They experienced searches. Some sensitive information on their salaries and contracts been taken through the pretext of my case. I'm going to pass some protocols of searches which I received eventually, but were never included in my case, which FSB carried in TNK-BP offices.
Well, I mean, that's one of the interesting things. I mean, for people that know the American justice system, the defendant is usually supposed to get all the information against them, all the evidence against them. Now, sometimes it doesn't happen, but usually that leads to appeals and other things like that. It's not just that the FSB framed you for something. It's that there was cooperation all the way up the justice system. There were corrupt judges, corrupt prosecutors. This was a systematic effort to try to delegitimize BP's place in Russia and also to frame you for some kind of a spy ring.
Absolutely. Just one quick fact which shows the nature of this trial and this whole incident. My judge and my the main prosecutor who approved my case going to the court, they are now on a so-called Magnitsky list. It's a U.S. Congress list of gross human rights violators. The same year when I was treated in Tverskoy District Court, there was a case of Sergei Magnitsky, a lawyer who tried to defend Hermitage Capital managers and a violent takeover of their company, and he eventually was murdered by Russian officials in 2009. And some of the officials from my case participated in his case as well.
Let me carry off. I was going to talk about that later, but now this is a good segue for it. I mean, a lot of people may know about the case of Litvinenko, about Mikhail Asin, who died here in Washington. Those are just the really public cases. This isn't something that only happens a couple times. Within Russia, within that part of the world, there are people who are just dying mysteriously. And only the ones that we know about, because it's polonium poisoning or somebody dying in D.C. that become news in the Western world. But this is a real trend within Russia itself.
Indeed. And in my case, what I eventually found out is that not only Western managers were harassed and intimidated with possible consequences. Some of them were directly told at the on the way to airport, for example, that they shouldn't come to Russia, otherwise they would face some violence. But head of BP, head of 10K BP at the time, Robert Dudley, who is now CEO of BP, according to some media publications, he was poisoned at the time when he didn't want to leave Russia during this conflict. And that was a hint to him that he should leave.
Yeah. Pretty strong hint.
Yes, pretty strong hint. And yeah. He neither confirms nor denies that, but informally, when I spoke with some people involved in this incident, I did get an informal confirmation of this incident. So Russians started poisoning people, and they continue to do that as sort of a method.
Right. I mean, for a lot of Americans that don't quite understand how Russian companies work, because it's not like this is Apple doing a hostile takeover of Microsoft. The Russian oil companies like Gazprom, these are technically independent companies, but all the top shareholders, all the top people are Russian government officials, including Vladimir Putin. So there's no real private industry going on here. This is a Russian government takeover.
Absolutely. This case shows all the involvement of the state, from labor inspections and visa immigration offices to FSB to statements by government officials. In fact, Deputy Prime Minister Shuvalov at some point said that he had to personally to interfere in the case, not necessarily on behalf of BP, which is quite revealing. I believe that in fact it's very misleading for American audience to think of existence of law enforcement, market, private property in Russia. They don't exist, and that's the main problem for U.S. businessmen dealing and U.S. government dealing with Russia. In a way, it should be considered a legally failed state, because corruption goes so much to the top level that we cannot talk about any basic legal rights.
Right. Well, I mean, you argue, and I think this is certainly something that people need to pay attention to, that the people who are in charge, the oligarchs, the powerful people, the kleptocrats at the top, come from three different circles. So the people like Putin and Medvedev and the Russian government, these aren't normal politics. In the United States, we rip on our politicians for being a little crooked here, a little taking too much money from a lobbyist there. That's a whole other ballgame in Russia. What three circles, what three broad organizations is the majority of the people from the Russian government coming from?
I tried to put my story in broader context, and for that I did research for think tanks since I moved to United States. And I find that values and practices of Russian officials and their actual background very often comes from three circles: Communist Party, KGB or other secret services, and organized criminal groups. They took the worst from each group and now share sort of basic values that they should only deal with very strong men in the West, like themselves,
right.
Only with wealthy individuals, that the rest of the public are prison camp dust, as they call it, nobodies mm-hmm. at the end of the hierarchy, that individual life doesn't cost anything, and that everyone is open for manipulation or control. So they believe it for that they can employ it for Russian citizens, but they also believe that they can employ it for Western citizens.
Well, and I think that's the tricky thing. I think if this was just happening inside Russia, we wouldn't be paying a whole lot of attention to it. I mean, Russia's a big and powerful country, but there are a lot of corrupt countries around the world. But the fact that you argue that they're trying to essentially export this corruption to try to undermine democratic institutions in the West, to undermine our laws, our values, our practices, and to me, most deviously, is to try to lead Western public opinion in bad directions. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, so I want to kind of hold off. But one thing I want to point the audience to is something that you've been involved in, and this is putting together this Kleptocracy Archive, which I think is a really great resource for anybody wanting to know more about this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, there is a so-called Kleptocracy Initiative at Hudson Institute, and I've been helping them with passing some of the documents from my case and facilitating the transfer from other cases. It's intended as a public resource for studying and understanding of not only Russian corruption and individual cases, but that it's a systemic situation, systemic phenomenon in post-Soviet space, in Russia and neighboring countries like Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Azerbaijan. Some of the oligarchs from those countries are very rich, and they have long hands and long reach into the West, and many, in many ways, for lobby groups, media acquisitions, hiring dignitaries, getting funding and then a name or some association with universities and research programs. I talk about there are several levels of export of corrosive practice. Some of them are outright criminal, like bribing and corruption and murders, as which you mentioned. But a lot of it is sort of highly debatable and disreputable. It's but not necessarily defined by law.
Right.
So
just sketchy.
Sketchy. I mean, yeah. I mean, some of these cases go to New York and London courts, and we learn about the practices that Russian oligarchs use against each other. The so-called krysha, roof, which is a protection system from superiors, many of whom come from KGB or party or criminal background, or just passing cash, big transactions in cash. But a lot of subversion is coming through trying to persuade to influence public discourse, or actually censoring public discourse. For example, there are universities and school programs where they would take money from oligarchs, and they would stop mentioning any critical analysis of Putin,
right.
Oligarchs, background of all these government officials, or conflict in Ukraine, and they would come up with this sort of seemingly plausible suggestions that we should not engage in Cold War with Russia, we should sort of appease it, but they wouldn't say appease it.
Right.
So some of the messages would be done by so-called useful idiots, just people who genuinely believe it for because they don't like establishment in the West and they are ready to sort of jump to the other side,
right.
Just because they hate their own establishment so much, and they don't want to really dig into and understand Russian establishment.
Right.
But some of these people who send these messages, I think they are very cynical, and they've been morally corrupted by Russian or other post-Soviet oligarchs. And this is exactly what is very dangerous and what I'm trying to raise awareness of.
Let me take a quick 2 minutes to tell you more about Harry's. Stop compromising on your shave and get started today. For far too long, you've either paid too much for a comfortable shave, or you've settled for a low price but low quality razor. Harry's offers something you've never had before, a great shave at a fair price. Harry's makes its own high quality razors, cuts out the middleman, and ships them directly to you for half the price of the leading brand. Good shave, good price. It's simple. Get the best of both with Harry's. Now, I know everyone tells you they have the best products, and you get inundated with ads across all mediums saying that this product or that product is the best. You, the listener, are probably a lot like me. Smart, educated, refined, ravishingly good-looking. Did I miss anything? Right. We don't fall for silly ads promising things that just aren't true. That's why I want to tell you more about how Harry's manufactures their razors. They bought a German factory, which means they own the entire process from grinding high-grade steel to sending razors to your door. This means that they can continually innovate to make your shave even better. Their team in Germany has been grinding high-grade steel into some of the world's sharpest blades since 1920. Today, more than 400 German engineers, designers, craftsmen, and production workers build and operate sophisticated, custom equipment that produces millions of precision blades every year. What this means for you, their blades will get even better. Your shave will get even better. They'll listen to your feedback of what makes a great shave and use their expertise to develop products that deliver you that experience. So Harry's starter set, called the Truman, is a great option for new customers and an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, there's a special offer for listeners of this show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code SPYCAST. Go to harrys.com right now and look for the Truman set. That's HARRYS.com. Enter the code SPYCAST at checkout to get $5 off and help support the show. Stop compromising. Give Harry's a try today. Let me take a step back and work our way back to the end of the Cold War, because I think a lot of our listeners would be interested to know how did all these people become incredibly powerful and incredibly rich? Because there's a lot of people who have different hypotheses out there about how all of a sudden the people who are in charge are organized crime, the intelligence agencies, and the Communist Party. And when I spent some time in Russia, and when I noticed that there's no middle class. You know, the cars on the streets are either $80,000 BMWs or these little junkers that are falling apart that are put together. It seems as though the people who had already been doing capitalism back in the 1980s, when it was still the Soviet Union, meaning organized crime, meaning the Communist Party system, meaning the intelligence communities, were perfectly placed when communism fell to take full advantage of the new system. Is that the kind of conventional wisdom coming out of Russia?
Everything you say is correct. I mean, there is a sort of small residual, I would say, middle class in Russia, but it's very different in its nature. It's mainly bureaucrats or office managers dependent on state budgets and state cash flows. So Putin built this amazing system where everyone depends on the state and the top elite depends on him personally. One of the perfect examples of that is how he actually came to power in St. Petersburg in the 1990s by organizing all sorts of schemes and frauds where he would implicate not only himself and his inner circle, but top officials, including mayor of the city and some top officials within the government, who then had to shield him. And some of these officials are actually now oligarchs and sort of pretend to be liberals, like Peter Avin, who personally shielded him in 1992. I would say that there are two main reasons how these people got so rich and got such power in the West. Firstly, there was a lot of property in Soviet Union, and it was obviously looted and corporate traded both in 1990s and 2000s. So sometimes some of this property would get into private hands, maybe not so ethically, but then people would start to try to run it on the rails of Western capitalism, but then they would get corporate traded and taken over. So one of the famous cases is UCAS, of course, but there are other, like Sunrise Company by Sergei Bobrylov. He's been harassed by my judge and the same oligarchs. But the second reason is because many of these oligarchs and ex-KGB turned wealthy businessmen, they receive a lot of support in the West. There is a whole wealth defense industry who helps them to a whole wealth defense industry, which helps them to legalize their money in the West and actually invest it in the West. And also, the system itself is quite open and porous. So one of the immediate ways which all oligarchs learned is offshore accounts. And Panama Papers reveal that amazingly. So as soon as the oligarchs put their money in offshore accounts and they don't get stopped, then there is a great author, Oliver Ballo, who talked about this three-stage process of legalizing money. As soon as they get this first stage, getting the money to the Western or offshore accounts, then they're really not stopped. Then they convert it into assets, second stage, and then they convert it into power and influence and exerting pressure on public discourse. And that's really corrosive and subversive.
It puts the Italian mob to shame. I mean, this is, that those practices were invented and perfected, by the Al Capones of the world, but this is at such a scale, now we're talking about a governmental scale, a government with nuclear weapons and with an immensely large military. You talked about trying to influence the West, and one of the things that you've been deeply involved with is trying to prevent this from happening from your alma mater. You mentioned that you went to Oxford. So I'll talk a little bit about how the Russian oligarchs have been trying to, for lack of a better word, trying to taint the legacy of Oxford University, which has been around for centuries at this point, and what you've been trying to do to get in the way. And you, not just you, you and others have been trying to do get in the way.
Absolutely. It's a horrible story. I had the best feelings about my university and my tutors there and administrators. So when in 2010, right after I moved to the West, I learned that the same oligarchs from TNKBP have been associated, started to penetrate the university with their donations, with their joint business awards. I was completely sure that as soon as I show my case and show the evidence from WikiLeaks and other sources, that they would immediately carry out new due diligence and revise their partnerships with oligarchs. To my amazement, they didn't, and I went all the way to Chancellor of University, Chris Patten, trying to persuade him and his team quietly that there should be some diplomatic solution to this. I was ridiculed, sort of patronized. I was sort of tacitly suggested that I should, just lead my new life in the West. One of the main tutors, one of my former tutors and now dean of the Blavatnik School of Government told me, Neri Woods, Professor Neri Woods, she told me, don't be a victim to all my suggestions to her to try to look for a solution. So I had to raise a public campaign, and there are quite a few people who support me, and there is a petition online on change.org, which is now signed by almost 500 people.
Yeah, well, so we'll put the link to that in the blurb, the actual explanation of this podcast. So if you're looking to see that petition, I'm not going to read the long, long, long thing, but we'll put the official link to that petition on this on the blurb for this podcast so people can see it.
I appreciate this. In a nutshell, what we did so far is we published an open letter signed by many famous Russian dissidents, political activists, and not only Russian, European and from other former Soviet Union countries. So we published it in The Guardian on 3rd of November. The only response from Oxford was sort of a parrot-style press release saying that they have the best due diligence process in the world, and it's all for the benefit of the world, and they carried out their due diligence. After sending some freedom of information requests and talking to people, we learned that they didn't have a single Russian-speaking person on due diligence committee. They had two people who actually failed in their own due diligence in their own industries. So one, a banker, and one now former security person who actually was not promoted in Cameron's government because of her links with oligarchs.
That's convenient.
Yes, that's world-class due diligence standards. When I tried to raise this the same issue during alumni weekend in Washington, which Oxford University had in April this year, when I spoke at the key, when I raised my hand and tried to speak at the Q&A session of the panel discussion with Susan Rice and some other dignitaries, Oxford security ran to me, like in Putin's Russia, grabbed me, and basically, essentially, closed my mouth. And I was taken out as a criminal in front of 300 people. And they told me if I appear again, I will face criminal charges just for trying to raise one question on oligarchs.
Well, you talked about the name of the this business school, the Blavatnik School. Let's talk a little bit about him, because as far as I can research, this guy is a U.S. philanthropist. This guy has been given to some great causes. He's an American citizen. Why shouldn't I think that?
Well, he actually wants to present himself as a U.S. philanthropist. Obviously, he moved to U.S. Through the same refugee program as I moved, through the same program for Jewish relatives, as I did later. But he kept his links with all his buddies in among oligarchs, and he's been involved in many questionable things in 1990s. But that's not my main concern with him. My biggest concern with him is that during this corporate raiding in 2008-2009, he always towed the line, which was as a shareholder. He had a big stake in the company, he always towed the line of Russian security services. The security man controlled by Russian oligarchs actually libeled me and participated actively in harassing Western managers helping fabricate this case. He never voted against any of the aggressive moves and steps by Russian oligarchs. He never spoke against propaganda and libel on TV or media against me, against other Western managers, against British Council. British Council is one of the main partners of Oxford University. It's because it's an educational organization in the United Kingdom. It's been wronged all the way from Dmitry Medvedev to tabloids in Russia, but no message from U.S. philanthropist Len Blavatnik. And then this whole picture, this whole takeover, which can be followed in WikiLeaks, and which I have excruciatingly put down on paper in the documents linked to my to our petition, it all led to the biggest offshore deal in Russian history in 2012-2013, where Putin and Sechin personally orchestrated a sale of 10 KBP to Rosneft, and these oligarchs received $28 billion in cash, which everyone sensible who studies Russia understands it was an unfair deal for Russian people and Russian budget. These people got overpaid by around $8 to $10 billion.
That's with a B, just to make sure everyone knows. It's billion with a B that
yes,
we're talking about.
Yes, yeah. And they now invest all this money in the West, including into Oxford. It's a good deal. You get $2-3 billion excessively over the market price for your assets, and then you spend £75 million on good governance and good government school and get your name on it.
So the Russian people, through the Russian government, are spending billions of dollars paying it to Russian oligarchs that are basically part of the government in the first place. Kind of like the money is being redistributed from the people, from the budget, from, you know, social programs to these oligarchs that are all tied directly to Putin.
Absolutely, yes. And it's been sort of a traditional scheme within Putin's government. It's not the first case, but it's the biggest. Panama Papers actually revealed that Len Blavatnik continues to have strong ties with Russian government because his company called iMedia iMedia Teka has a joint business with Deputy Minister of Russian Internal Affairs.
And for Americans, think of the Department of the Interior or something like that that deals with national parks. The Minister of Internal Affairs in Russia is not somebody that looks at national parks.
No, he's not. It's MVD. It's the ministry which employs most of these gross human rights violators listed on the U.S. Congress list that I mentioned before. It's the main ministry which harasses Russian opposition and involved in many operations with Ukraine, with Georgia, with any critical opinion within Russia. It's involved with many criminal investigations in the West which are stopped by that ministry, like Spanish prosecution investigation of Putin's activity and his cronies from St. Petersburg. This MVD has really blocked it in many ways. So, and it's just one tiny thing about continued connections between these oligarchs and Russian government and security services.
I've talked to you about Blue Apron in the past, and I'm so glad they have continued to support SpyCast. Blue Apron seems to have been invented for someone like me. I don't have a lot of time to shop and think about what to eat every day. My days are long, and it's so tempting just to say forget it and get carry out if I'm forced to decide on cooking. And most importantly, I suck at cooking, which is a bit of a problem when talking about feeding myself. Blue Apron solves all of these issues. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. They do this because Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set high-quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. For example, seafood is sourced sustainably under the standards developed by partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Their beef is raised humanely, chickens are free-range, pork is raised naturally, and regenerative farming practices are used for produce. So whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. Blue Apron also gives you variety. New recipes are created weekly and are not repeated within a year, so you can choose your meals from a variety of recipes or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. They're also flexible. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. This is great for someone like me who travels for work. If I'll be out of town, I can just switch the delivery to the following week and I never miss out on great Blue Apron food. And it's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less, even by someone like me. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/spycast. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/spycast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So for Americans that don't care about Oxford University, although we should, but let's bring it a little bit closer to home. Blavatnik, which we've talked about now with Panama Papers, are showing him dealing with the Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs. We talked about him getting all this kickback money from, you know, the oil takeover. You didn't talk about the fact that actually there's two cases that he's being investigated or fined by the Department of Justice here in the United States. But he and others are donating directly to American politicians, to American companies, running American businesses, academic institutions. I was very sad when I saw this, invested in a very popular Broadway musical that's going on right now. So can you talk a little bit about his ties, or not just his, let's bring it beyond him, because it's more than just some of these old Russian oligarchs' ties to institutions that we consider very Western, very American, that where we'd be very surprised if we heard that there's the hand of the Russian government involved in this.
Firstly, I want to say that I don't have information that Blavatnik and other oligarchs received specifically a kickback.
Right.
But there's overwhelming evidence.
I get to say that. You don't have.
Yeah. Oh, there's overwhelming evidence that they received excessive money.
Right.
And Putin himself criticized this deal. Just 8 months after he approved it, he pretended in late 2013 that it was the decision of Russian oligarchs to run it through offshores. So he, in typical KGB style, he diverted attention away from the overall excessive sum of the deal to the fact that it was run through offshores and didn't pay enough taxes to Russian budget. But there are both problems with that deal, which Oxford University has many experts to actually acknowledge, but they just deliberately don't want to look at any of these events. To return back to oligarchs, so it's not only Blavatnik which have been involved in UK and US, but also the other 10K, Russians call them tankers, tankiste, oligarchs. So it's Mikhail Friedman, Piotr Ivan, Viktor Vekselberg, German Hahn, and Blavatnik. So these people all received excessive cash from Russian government. They all participated in this corporate trading against BP. But then they really have huge outreach and connections in the West. So Friedman and Ivan had, even before Blavatnik, they had a joint business award with Said Business School in Oxford between 2007 and 2011.
And this is the part. This part of the company Alpha. Is that what you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, yeah. It's part of Alpha. They are heads of Alpha Bank, and these people were essentially deciding who is doing the best investment into Russia with that award. And so it was McDonald's, Intel, Unilever, Danone, these sort of companies that received these awards from their hands. Right at the time, as we now know, when one of the subsidiaries of Alpha, Vimpelcom, the company which they essentially control, was investigated by Department of Justice and Dutch authorities in 17 jurisdictions over one of the biggest bribe cases in modern history. In February this year, Department of Justice fined Vimpelcom $795 million. And Vimpelcom confirmed that they did wrong and they involved themselves in criminal activity.
I mean, that's $795 million is an extraordinary.
The department in DOJ called it the biggest kleptocracy asset case. My suspicion is that's why Oxford University closed that joint award quietly, and now they erased all the information about this deal, about this joint award, because they learned about this investigation. I don't have information about these specific oligarchs operating these schemes, but no one questioned them how much they knew about this. It's their main company which ran tens of millions of dollars of bribes to Uzbekistan, to Gulnara Karimova and her associates, the president's daughter, in 17 jurisdictions. So that thing was happening in Oxford. Other things, these oligarchs have had a very close association with Cannon Institute at Wilson Center. And so Viktor Vekselberg received an award there in 2007, and Piotr Ivan received a corporate citizenship award on 3rd of November last year. He invited Lesin, the guy who got killed on DuPont Circle, to that ceremony, and that ceremony took place just a couple of days before Lesin's very strange death. These oligarchs are now publicly announcing that they are expanding their lobbying activity in Washington and that they're investing $3 billion in U.S. healthcare. They already have a lot of investments in U.S. in real estate and in London. They have investments in Uber, in telecommunications. A lot of that money is coming from that corporate trading and that excessive deal in 2012-2013.
Well, I believe you, but I want to make sure that the listener is on the same page and they can make their own decision for themselves. It can sound to some, and if I were Putin, I would be arguing against this, saying, well, yeah, there's a lot of shady Russian companies. There's a lot of shadiness going on at some of the highest levels of Russian industry. But why are you trying to blame me for all this? How can we trace this back to Putin? What is the evidence that says this is all being run or at least signed off on, or at the very, very least, he knows about it and he's looking the other way. How can we trace this all the way to the top of the Russian hierarchy?
Well, firstly, these oligarchs have had very close relationship with Putin and his very close associates since the early 1990s. So Ivan and Friedman have been friends and partners, business partners with, and worked in the same, sometimes worked in the same State Department with Mikhail Fratkov and Surkov, some of the people who we know are associated with Russian security. Fratkov is currently head of SVR. Secondly, my case shows that security personnel in TNK-BP, who was fully controlled by Russian shareholders, cooperated with FSB closely in fabricating and harassing Western managers. There is no doubt about that. There are audio recordings with libelous statements from court proceedings. There are documents. And one of the protocols of searches from my case, which I'm passing to you, is it actually shows that a very strange relationship between oligarchs and Russian security services. So during the searches, which took place in 2008, Russian security found out that governmental relations department of Russian shareholders actually copies a lot of documents from Russian government. And there is exchange between Patrushev and Zubkov. There are letters on with headers of Rosneft and Gazprom to the government, all sorts of draft laws, secret protocols, all copied and were present in GR department of TNK-BP. But FSB didn't do anything with this information. They kept it low. So this is just maybe minor, but evidence. To return to a broader picture, Putin is very happy with these people to invest their money in all sorts of assets in the West. It's a perfect way to present these people as private businessmen, not so much associated with the regime, whose money actually come with the help from Kremlin.
Right.
And it's a way to circumvent sanctions.
Well, how does Russia Today play into this? Because I think that a lot of Americans are now becoming more and more familiar with this TV channel that is claiming to be a independent, objective news source. Most of us have it on our cable or DirecTV or whatever. And they have some very high-level Americans and Westerners as either correspondents or as speakers. The former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Mike Flynn, has been a frequent contributor to Russia Today. The woman running for the Green Party candidacy for president, Jill Stein, has been a Russia Today contributor. It seems legit on face. Can you tell us a little bit about why it's not?
Well, because a lot has changed since Soviet times. In Soviet times, Russian Soviet propaganda had to present an ideological stance and talk about developments within Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact and then try to be critical of the West. Now, Russia Today only deals with the West and has only to sow divisions in the West. So the whole idea is not to present some new ideology or sort of solution, but just to sow division and bring in far-right, far-left people, all sorts of freaks and conspiracy theorists, and show only vice and problems of the West. Never critically acclaim some of the achievements,
right,
some of the good relations that the West has with the rest of the world. Only show, also the idea is to not only sow division, but to force people not to believe their own government or their media. Just to say that everyone is corrupt, all the media is corrupt everywhere, and there is no difference in corruption. So Russian corruption, Chinese corruption is the same as U.S. corruption. You could also hint, like I've heard in Britain that some people, after watching Rush Today, they believe that Scottish referendum, referendum on Scottish independence was as rigged as a referendum in Crimea, which is not. So basically, it's a propaganda which aims to switch off your analytical thinking and just to put in all these conspiracy theories in your head and not to believe even your own neighbor.
Well, and it's really nuanced. It's not like the old Soviet active measures system where they claim that we created AIDS here in the United States or that JFK was assassinated by the CIA. These are kind of tinfoil hat wearing over the top conspiracy theories. They're just subtle enough that you might go, oh, you know, like their coverage of Ukraine is just nuanced enough that it's very, it's not so blatant like, oh, the Ukrainians are all Nazis. Like, yeah, of course they're not. But they're just subtle enough to talk about, you know, neo-fascists or extreme nationalists or the fact that most people in Ukraine want Russian intervention. Enough that you can't really challenge it unless you're really at a high level of understanding.
Yes, I think in a way we're back to battle of ideas. Even if we'll, there is a lack of ideology on the other side and just cynicism, some of these ideas are subversive and can be shown as subversive. So, for example, some of these cultural centers in Washington, they only bring Putin's loyalists and present them to establishment here. So we can expose that. That shows bias. But some of this discourse is difficult to just name tag as subversive. So people are saying, let's not have another Cold War. Let's find diplomatic solutions, even when Russia attacks Ukraine. And there is no immediate diplomatic solution. For example, when they try to counteract U.S. Congress' decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. So they would. There are many, again, as I repeat, useful idiots or people who genuinely believe that, who engage in this all sorts of discourses which are useful to Putin, but which can only be met with details, facts. So, for example, you would say to many people who say we shouldn't have another post, another Cold War, you should say that it's not Cold War, that it's that this that Russia and some post-Soviet states use NATO as a pretext, that they attack themselves. So you have to look at each incident and bring back analytical TV, bring back analytical articles and evidence, and engage youth from both sides, engage Russian-speaking or Kazakh-speaking, Azerbaijani-speaking opposition who know details.
Right.
I think it's a game for a long term, which is not going away quickly, and people in the West should start to not only see. I am all for critical thinking and about your own government, about your own parties, but to see things in perspective and compare things in the West and in Russia, and start to value your own democracy, start to value what you already have. Even if it's tarnished and not perfect, it's still completely... So Scottish referendum might not have been perfect, but it's definitely different from a referendum in Crimea, which was done under the gunpoint.
We would like to thank our two sponsors for today's SpyCast, Harry's and Blue Apron. Harry's will give you $5 off the first purchase with the promo code SpyCast. Go to harrys.com right now and look for the Truman Set. That's harrys.com. Enter code SPYCAST at checkout to get $5 off and help support the show. And check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/SPYCAST. That is blueapron.com/SPYCAST. Well, Ilya Zaslavsky is working tirelessly to get this message out, so we're going to help him do it. On the blurb for this podcast, you can find that link to the change.org petition. Take a chance to read it. I expect we're going to have you back at some point in the future. We wanted to lay this out for the audience for in a broad sense the first time. So thank you, Ilya, for taking the time to talk to us here today at SPYCAST.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's @INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.